Forgive me for being unclear. I think Craig has already forgiven me in the illustration involving Craig, who was here, by the way, and Heather. That was meant to be a fictitious illustration, although I am certain that Craig is a generous man. I've been greatly encouraged just getting to know many of you and understanding what's going on in the Irish scene, just knowing that there is so much gospel ministry taking place. I know it's not all exhausted by what's been represented in this room, but it is a great encouragement to me. I just didn't know that there was this much going on, and I praise God for you. May you be granted the strength you need to keep going through 2013 and beyond. Well, humanly speaking, what happened one day in the spring of 1986 was nothing much to write home about. If you'd been there, you wouldn't have noticed anything particularly remarkable. What occasion am I talking about? Well, as I say, it was nothing very much, just a gesture. Someone handed me a shirt, a singlet, in the context of a university athletics meeting. That's all. Nothing much. But that gesture left a deep impression on me, and although it wasn't what led me to Christ, it was the gospel that led me to Christ, it was one of a number of developments that occurred around the time of my conversion and that I associate with my conversion. This gesture was a small but powerful illustration and outworking of the gospel. For this guy who handed me the singlet was in fact sacrificing his singlet. I needed this item of clothing in order to compete in a race, and although it's true that he didn't need this precise piece of clothing at that precise moment in time, he had a lot of fish to fry that day. He was the captain, and I was barely a member of the team, so barely that I didn't even have the right equipment. I can assure you that looking after me was not his top job that day, and he could no doubt have assured you that putting on a sweaty singlet used by somebody else is not the best form of preparation for one's races. But this team captain was a believer in Jesus Christ, and he was different, authentic, loving, and instead of giving me short shrift, which is probably what I deserved, he displayed generosity, kindness, sacrifice on my behalf. And so what might have looked like a very ordinary gesture was in fact something rather out of the ordinary, whose scope and impact were considerable. And 27 years later, this act remains etched on my memory as one of the events that was linked to my, in turn, becoming a believer in Jesus Christ. Humanly speaking, what happened one day after the barley and wheat harvest during the period of the Judges was nothing to write home about. If you'd been there, you wouldn't have noticed anything particularly remarkable. What event am I talking about? Well, as I say, it was nothing very much. Just a gesture. Someone took a sandal off his foot and handed it to someone else. It's just a sign. At that time and in that society, it was the way in which you signalled that a transaction had taken place. What transaction? Well, nothing particularly striking. Someone had just bought a patch of land. Let's read the first 10 verses of chapter 4. Now Boaz had gone up to the gate and sat down there, and behold, the Redeemer of whom Boaz had spoken came by. So Boaz said, "Turn aside, friend, sit down here." And he turned aside and sat down. He took 10 men of the elders of the city and said, "Sit down here." So they sat down. Then he said to the Redeemer, "Naomi, who has come back from the country of Moab, is selling the parcel of land that belonged to our relative Elimelech. So I thought I would tell you of it and say, buy it in the presence of those sitting here and in the presence of the elders of my people. If you will redeem it, redeem it. But if you will not, tell me, that I may know. For there is no one besides you to redeem it, and I come after you." And he said, "I will redeem it." Then Boaz said, "The day you buy the field from the hand of Naomi, you also acquire Ruth the Moabite, the widow of the dead, in order to perpetuate the name of the dead in his inheritance." Then the Redeemer said, I cannot redeem it for myself, lest I impair my own inheritance. Take my right of redemption yourself, for I cannot redeem it. Now, this was the custom in former times in Israel concerning redeeming and exchanging. To confirm a transaction, one drew off his sandal and gave it to the other, and this was the manner of attesting in Israel. So when the redeemer said to Boaz, "Buy it for yourself," he drew off his sandal. Then Boaz said to the elders and all the people, "You are witnesses this day that I have bought from the hand of Naomi all that belonged to Elimelech and all that belonged to Chilion and to Mahlon. Also Ruth the Moabite, the widow of Mahlon, I have bought to be my wife, to perpetuate the name of the dead in his inheritance, that the name of the dead may not be cut off from among his brothers and from the gate of his native place. You are witnesses this day." Well, you may have acted as a witness for someone signing an important document, or you've had to ask someone to serve as a witness for you. Maybe you've had a friend who's come up asking you, "Will you act as a witness to my signature? I'm just going to sign here. I need you to sign afterwards by way of declaring that you've seen me sign." So the friend signs, just underneath it says, "Signed in the presence of," and then you append your name and your signature. Well, maybe these things over here all happen electronically these days, and if that's the case, please forgive me. But that used to happen, and it's this sort of signing in the presence of business that's going on in our passage here. It seems, though, that there are quite a few witnesses in this case, indeed three groups of witnesses. 10 elders of the city, another group of people who are seated, and the crowd. And what happened that day was an ordinary business deal. I'm guessing there would have been hundreds like it. It was nothing particularly striking. Someone bought a patch of land. And yet, when you have more information to hand, when you're in the picture on the circumstances surrounding this deal, you realise that ordinary is not the right word. Quite the opposite. The scope and the impact of this deal were out of the ordinary. And our task in this last session is to try to understand the importance of this transaction in the context of the story that this book relates, and in the context of our story. In particular, there are four consequences of this deal that I'd like to draw your attention to. First, a Moabite marries an Israelite. A Moabite marries an Israelite. During the course of the first two chapters, the narrator has already highlighted the fact that Ruth is a foreigner, a Moabite. And now in chapter 4 we read again, twice, of her nationality. We've already been informed extensively that Ruth is a Moabite. We've already been reminded extensively that Ruth is a Moabite. And here is being underlined yet again as Boaz's words are reported, verse 5. Boaz said, "The day you buy the field from the hand of Naomi, you also acquire Ruth the Moabite." Verse 10, "Also Ruth the Moabite, the widow of Mahlon, I have bought to be my wife." This Moabite marries an Israelite. And as we saw yesterday, this is, in one sense, scandalous, or the day before yesterday, scandalous. How could a member of this top-tier enemy people come anywhere near marrying a respectable Israelite? Well, the point is that if you worship the God of Israel, your ethnic background was no longer an obstacle to full integration amongst God's people. And so ultimately there could be no theological objection to this marriage taking place. That doesn't mean there are no obstacles at all in the way of this marriage. Last time, just before our break, the camera zoomed in on the threshing floor, and Boaz explained that he didn't have the first refusal of Ruth in terms of buying this land. Ruth will get married, but to whom? She's going to become the wife of the Israelite who buys back the patch of land. And it's true that we're kept in suspense. We know that Boaz wants to marry Ruth. We know that marriage to Ruth is indissolubly linked to the redeeming of the parcel of land. But we know too that there's someone other than Boaz who's first in the queue for redeeming the parcel of land. Who is this person? Very interesting. The potential redeemer is, in theory, close to Naomi, closer than Boaz, but he's not named in the text. And the way in which he's referred to underlines that. In verse 1, Boaz calls him friend, or perhaps better, Mr. So-and-so. We can imagine Boaz is respectful, but he's not intimate. Come over here, sir. Do please take a seat. So we're clear that Mr. So-and-so, sir, has the first opportunity to buy the land. And if he chooses to exercise his rights, he will become Ruth's husband. Which way is he going to jump? Verse 4. So I thought I would tell you of it and say, buy it in the presence of those sitting here and in the presence of the elders of my people. If you will redeem it, redeem it. But if you will not, tell me that I may know, for there is no one besides you to redeem it, and I come after you. And he said, I will redeem it. Dear, oh dear, oh dear, Mr. So-and-so does want to buy the land. Things are not looking good. But Mr. So-and-so has an impulsive streak and doesn't always look at the small print. And just before he signs on the dotted line, so to speak, he discovers that buying this land wouldn't really be a good business deal for him. It wouldn't be for the benefit of his family, but for the benefit of the mother-in-law, Naomi, and her family. Someone gives him a steer and points to the critical sentence in the contract. Under this transaction, the redeemer comes to be considered the son of Naomi, and Naomi's family line is thereby perpetuated. And Mr. So-and-so says to himself, this is a serious deal breaker. I get nothing out of this. Nothing at all. This is one-way traffic. This is just me spending money on behalf of someone else. This is not at all in my interest. He's now understood the character of the contract. And so, verse 6, then the Redeemer said, I cannot redeem it for myself, lest I impair my own inheritance. Take my right of redemption yourself, for I cannot redeem it. So there's the change of mind on the part of Mr. So-and-so, who withdraws from this business deal, leading us to heave a sigh of relief. Because we now know that Ruth can become the wife of Boaz, who is so different from Mr. So-and-so. Boaz believes in kindness, believes in sacrifice, believes in generosity. He has those qualities running through his veins. And this marriage union does warm our hearts. This beats any wedding at Slane Castle for anyone who has spiritually attuned spectacles on. We've come to see how remarkably attractive these two characters are. And you kind of want to say to Ruth, you have landed the most incredible man. And you want to say to Boaz, you have landed the most incredible woman. A Moabite maybe, but you find me someone like that in Israel. But there's a question that's left hanging. Why is it that this patch of land holds the key to Naomi's future? Why does everything hinge on this act of redemption? Let's consider the second consequence of the deal. The name of Naomi's family is perpetuated. The name of Naomi's family is perpetuated. Verse 5. Then Boaz said, the day you buy the field from the hand of Naomi, you also acquire Ruth the Moabite, the widow of the dead, in order to perpetuate the name of the dead in his inheritance. Verse 10, also Ruth the Moabite, the widow of Mahlon, I have bought to be my wife to perpetuate the name of the dead in his inheritance, that the name of the dead may not be cut off from among his brothers and from the gate of his native place. This matter of the importance of a name isn't that easy for us to grasp, it seems to me. Let me try and give you an illustration that will help us to go some way down the track of appreciating what's at stake here. Barack Obama was born in Hawaii. He didn't have much contact with his father during his childhood, probably no. When Barack Obama was only 2 years old, his father left for Boston to carry out studies at Harvard. When he was 10 years old, he saw his father again over a period of 1 month before his father left for Kenya. Now, that brief period of contact with him, that month, was highly significant for Obama. He started asking questions about his identity, about his background, about his past, about his future. And several years later, Obama traveled to Kenya in order to try to understand his family background, his roots. His father had died by this stage. But when he was there, he spoke to somebody who had known his father. And this is what Barack Obama writes. "For the first time in my life, I felt the comfort, the firmness of identity that a name might provide. How it could carry an entire history in other people's memory. No one in Kenya would ask me how to spell my name or mangle it with unfamiliar tongue." Now, with this illustration, we're getting close to the significance of the name for Naomi's family, for there was the danger that the name would be extinguished. But we need to go further. In order to appreciate just how serious the extinction of a name would be, we need to step into the shoes of an Israelite living under the Old Covenant. I'm going to ask you to listen to a part of a psalm. It happens to be Psalm 109, but you can just listen. In this psalm, David asks God to curse one of his opponents. We need to be careful. David is living in an earlier period of salvation history relative to us. The regime was not the same then as it is for us. It would not be right for us automatically and directly to appropriate every element of this kind of prayer. But what I'm going to do is to ask you to note the curses that David invokes upon his enemy. Just read a few verses from this psalm. "May his days be few. May his children be fatherless and his wife a widow. May his children wander about and beg, seeking food far from the ruins they inhabit. Let there be none to extend kindness to him, nor any to pity his fatherless children. May his posterity be cut off. May his name be blotted out in the second generation." That's one of the worst curses you could have heard. The bottom line is this: if your family name is cut off, it's as if you cease to exist. Now, we're nearly there. The last piece in the jigsaw is this: the name of the family was closely tied to the possession of a part of the promised land. Here in Bray in 2013, there's a free market for property. The Bray Brethren Assembly raises the money, the Bray Brethren Assembly buys the building, the Bray Brethren Assembly owns the building. You own a house in Bray, you put it up for sale, somebody from Germany can come and buy it. But in Israel, property, real estate, remained within the family. What seems to have happened in our story is that Naomi's family no longer has the right to benefit from the patch of land in question. It seems that Naomi's late husband Elimelech sold that right before taking the family to Moab. But on paper, the patch of land still belongs to Naomi's family. She can't use it, she can't benefit from it, and she can't buy back use of the land because she hasn't got any money. And to cap it all, this patch of land is liable to disappear from the family because the family itself is liable to disappear. Because Naomi doesn't have any children. In other words, the name of Naomi's family is on the way out, is liable to be cut off, is in danger of being blotted out. But under this transaction, the measures involved will solve that problem and perpetuate the family name. The patch of land will be bought back, Naomi will be able to benefit from it economically, but more important is the fact that the land will remain in the family because the family will be preserved. How come? Because under the marriage element of the contract, Boaz now comes to take up the role, as it were, of a son to Naomi. It's as if he replaces one of the sons she lost in Moab. Make a note of Deuteronomy 25 if you want to chase up this sort of idea, but there isn't really a full background in the law of Moses to these complicated transactions here in Ruth 4. Boaz moves in to perpetuate the family name, and assuming Boaz and Ruth have children, the family name will be perpetuated. Now we can see that Naomi is able to find rest. Economic stability, social respectability. You remember her problems. No husband, no children, no marriage prospects, no social status, no value in the eyes of society, no economic provision, so no food, no future, maybe even no life. Now those problems are being solved. Listen to the next part of the story from verse 11. Then all the people who were at the gate and the elders said, "We are witnesses. May the Lord make the woman who is coming into your house like Rachel and Leah, who together built up the house of Israel. May you act worthily in Ephrathah and be renowned in Bethlehem. And may your house be like the house of Perez, whom Tamar bore to Judah, because of the offspring that the Lord will give you by this young woman." So Boaz took Ruth, and she became his wife. And he went into her, and the Lord gave her conception, and she bore a son. Then the women said to Naomi, "Blessed be the Lord, who has not left you this day without a redeemer, and may his name be renowned in Israel." This deal leads to the birth of a child, which allows us to reflect on a third consequence now. A redeemer is raised up for Naomi. A redeemer is raised up for Naomi. And we might start feeling confused here. For Boaz is Naomi's redeemer. He's the one who becomes, as it were, her son. He's the one who redeems the land with his money. He's the one who provides for Naomi to have rest. And that's true. But the text requires us to focus from now on the son of Boaz. Let's reread verses 13 and 14. So Boaz took Ruth, and she became his wife, and he went into her, and the Lord gave her conception, and she bore a son. Then the women said to Naomi, "Blessed be the Lord, who has not left you this day without a redeemer, and may his name be renowned in Israel." Here, Naomi's redeemer is the one who's just been born this day. The time has come for us to turn our attention to a child, to the one who will preserve Naomi's family, to the boy who provides for Naomi's family name to be perpetuated. The Redeemer has been born. Can we recall what we said of Naomi in chapter 1? She was on the road that leads to death. You recall the women of Bethlehem who apparently had trouble recognizing Naomi? But now, look what the women of Bethlehem can say as they stare into the eyes of this little baby boy. Verse 15. "He shall be to you a restorer of life and a nourisher of your old age. For your daughter-in-law who loves you, who is more to you than seven sons, has given birth to him." "He shall be to you a restorer of life." No longer on the road that leads to death, Naomi finds life again. No longer, as she put it in chapter 1, empty On the contrary, she now finds profound fulfillment. No longer, as she put it in chapter 1, a life that was bitter. On the contrary, now life is sweet, pleasant for her. No longer Mara, but Naomi. No longer an impossible set of circumstances with no possible solution. On the contrary, the solution that God has orchestrated is breathtaking. No longer facing catastrophe, tragedy, desperation, and so without hope, but now embracing rest, life, a future full of joy. God has worked to bless Naomi far more abundantly than all she had asked or thought. But we mustn't lose sight of the key role played by Ruth in all this. We've just seen it in verse 15. I'll read verse 15 again and then on to verse 16. He shall be to you a restorer of life and a nourisher of your old age, for your daughter-in-law who loves you, who is more to you than seven sons, has given birth to him. Then Naomi took the child and laid him on her lap and became his nurse. It's because Ruth loved her mother-in-law that this turnaround has been able to occur. It's because Ruth insisted on tying her lot to her mother-in-law's lot that this turnaround has been able to occur. It's because Ruth is a worthy woman, a woman of noble character, that this turnaround has been able to occur. At the end of the day, you can say, as the women of Bethlehem put it, that Ruth is worth more to Naomi than seven sons. And now the solution takes shape. The turnaround is made concrete as Ruth gives birth to this son. And one can easily imagine the story ending there. The solution is clear. The turnaround has occurred. The search for rest is over. The TV drama experts would freeze the frame as Naomi picks up the baby. There is the miracle that God has worked. You look at the baby boy and you know that Naomi has found life, a name, rest. But if one were to freeze the frame there, it shouldn't be for too long. The son of Boaz and Ruth is not where the book ends, for there is a fourth important consequence of the deal. A great king emerges from this line. A great king emerges from this line. Let's read from verse 17. And the women of the neighborhood gave him a name, saying, "A son has been born to Naomi." They named him Obed. He was the father of Jesse, the father of David. Now these are the generations of Perez. Perez fathered Hezron. Hezron fathered Ram. Ram fathered Aminadab. Aminadab fathered Nahshon. Nahshon fathered Salmon. Salmon fathered Boaz. Boaz fathered Obed. Obed fathered Jesse. And Jesse fathered David. There are two family trees there. Did you notice? The descendants of this family are twice traced for us. Twice the genealogy ends with David. Boaz, Obed, Jesse, David. Boaz, Obed, Jesse, David. Boaz, Obed, Jesse, David. Solomon, Rehoboam, Abijah, Asaph, Jehoshaphat, Joram, Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, Hezekiah, Manasseh, Amos, Josiah, Jeconiah, Shealtiel, Zerubbabel, Abiud, Eliakim, Azor, Zadok, Achim, Eliud, Eleazar, Mathan, Jacob, Joseph, the husband of Mary, of whom Jesus was born, who is called Christ. A great king emerges from this line, great David, and then 28 generations later, great David's greater son, a greater than David, a great redeemer. Humanly speaking, what happened one Easter day in 30 or 33 AD was nothing to write home about. If you'd been there, in one sense, you wouldn't have noticed anything particularly remarkable. What occasion am I talking about? Well, as I say, in one sense, it was nothing very much. It was someone being put to death, a criminal, apparently, just outside the city walls in Jerusalem. The form of the death was horrible, crucifixion. But that was the nature of the death that some people had to undergo. There would have been hundreds of others like it. In fact, you could see three of them in a row there that day. But what might have looked like a fairly routine execution was in fact something out of the ordinary, whose scope and impact were considerable. For the fact of the matter is that this criminal was no criminal at all. He was treated as a criminal, but he was innocent. Yet he died in the place of those who, in God's eyes, are criminals. Folk like you and me. By that death, he attained forgiveness for our crimes. More than that, he provided for us to be clothed in his righteousness, his innocent life, his perfect life, his positively righteous life is credited to us. God's anger, which should have been poured out on us, was poured out on him. There wasn't a transfer of sandal to signify that the transaction had taken place. But you could have heard these words uttered by the man who died in our place. It is finished. The deal was done. The redemption was accomplished. He redeemed by his blood people from every nation. We who place our confidence in that man who died, Jesus Christ, we form the church redeemed by his blood with a view to being presented to our husband, Jesus Christ, without spot or wrinkle or any such thing, but holy and without blemish. Instead of having to face being cut off, condemned to hell forever, we receive what Isaiah 56 calls an everlasting name that shall not be cut off. Instead of being empty, we are blessed in Christ with every spiritual blessing in the heavenly places. Instead of being dead in the trespasses and sins in which we once walked, we've been made alive together with Christ. Instead of bitterness, we're filled with joy now as we anticipate our family inheritance in the world to come, an inheritance that's imperishable, undefiled, and unfading. Instead of facing catastrophe, tragedy, desperation, and so being without hope, we enjoy rest and life and anticipate a glorious future. The women of Bethlehem could see the enormity of the consequences of Naomi's being redeemed. The transaction had utterly transformed her. Can the folk around us see the enormity of the consequences of our being redeemed by Jesus Christ? Are they aware that the transaction has utterly transformed us? We have been redeemed from the futile ways of this world. Is that obvious to people around us? If the answer is not particularly, is that because we ourselves are guilty of downplaying the significance of this transaction? Is it because we underestimate the impact and scope of this event that took place 2,000 years ago? As we look back over this book, we can see how it illuminates in a fresh way the wonder of the cross. And we can see also that it calls upon us to follow in Boaz's footsteps and follow in Ruth's footsteps and being marked by kindness as believers. Our lives should be bearing fruit in every good work, as Paul puts it. Particularly our lives. For we particularly, are we not, are required to be models. A word to, I don't know, those of us who are over 35 say, younger Christians coming up behind us, they take a look at our lives, don't they? And they say to themselves, this is what they say, thank God for the model of my pastor, the elders of our church, the ministry team, the group leader. They're so other person-centered. Their lives are packed full of acts of sacrifice, generosity, kindness towards others. They are godly examples, and I aspire to being like them. That's what they're saying about us, isn't it? Well, if you don't feel uncomfortable, I do. Maybe some of us need to take a couple of minutes before the day is out to jot down a few acts of sacrifice, generosity, kindness that we could do over the next few weeks. Some of us may need to inculcate a habit, create the disciplines that will drive us to be more proactive in acts of sacrifice and generosity and kindness. And we can think of various areas in our lives and run through them in our minds: family, ministry, neighbourhood, friends, enemies. We could come back to our little list in a month's time. I'm not necessarily saying that Ruth is a particularly prophetic book for our generation, but maybe it is. I don't know the scene here in the way that you do. You'll be able to work out whether sacrifice is a clear hallmark of the lives of evangelicals in 21st century Ireland. You'll know whether it would be appropriate to plead with the Lord to raise up more Boazes and Ruths for evangelical churches in this country. But if there's been this emphasis in the book on acts of kindness, there's also been an emphasis on the extraordinary kindness of God. And it would be a mistake to cultivate a life full of acts of kindness if those acts were not anchored in all that God has done for us in Jesus Christ. We will want to be marked by other person-centeredness, by self-sacrifice, by gracious deeds towards others. For this reason, we have begun to appreciate aright the scope and impact of the redemption accomplished by our great King Jesus. Biblically speaking, we'd be putting the cart before the horse. We were to work up acts of kindness without having benefited from the kindness of God demonstrated in the cross of Christ. That's where it all begins. And if we're having trouble motivating ourselves to live self-sacrificially, it may be because we're running the risk of underestimating the scope of the transaction that took place just outside Jerusalem 2,000 years ago. We have a marriage, a name, a redeemer, a great king. The scope and impact of the transaction we looked at in chapter 4 is quite something, but it's nothing compared to the scope and impact of the transaction that it anticipates. We were without hope, but God has blessed us far more abundantly than all we ask or think. To him be the glory forever and ever. Amen.
Once again, can we just take a few moments just to reflect on words and just